Welcome to The Sacramentalist, a podcast where the ancient Christian faith is brought to bear on issues prevalent in modern culture. We're your host. I'm Father Miles Hickson.
And I'm Father Wesley Walker.
And welcome back to another installment in our series on Catholic social teaching. In today's episode, we're going to be looking at a topic that can be fairly controversial in both Christian and non-Christian circles, and that many faithful Christians disagree upon. And so that's kind of the caveat up front. And this is the topic of war and peace, and the church's understanding of nations going to war or civilians being able to rebel against oppressive governments. Now, as another caveat, I just want to say that this discussion, as is the case with a lot of what we do on this podcast, is intended to be something of a primer or introduction on the topic. So much can and probably should be said on this topic. And so we hope to bring an expert on, perhaps in a future bonus episode, who can lead us into deeper discussion and to think more critically from the Christian classical tradition on these issues. But for today, we're going to begin the conversation by looking at the two ends of what might be considered the Christian spectrum of this issues, just war theory and then some sort of pacifism. And so let's begin with just war theory. So simply put, just war theory is a school of thought that deals with why and how wars are fought and whether or not they rise to the level of quote-unquote just. That is, whether they are A, acceptable acts of combat in the eyes of Scripture and the Church, and B, whether the tactics used in war, as in how the actual war is carried out, are acceptable in the same regard in light of Scripture and the teaching of the Church. Now, recently, a third aspect has actually been added into this discussion of just war theory, and that is the right and proper reconstruction of a society after war.
Which is a necessary move given, you know, 20th century history. I mean, you know, you look at what World War I did to Germany, for instance, and how that ended up causing World War II. And I think you can probably look at some of the violences in the Middle East as far as American foreign policy and see how that really just perpetuates cycles of violence that really doesn't fix anything. It actually may end up making it worse in some ways.
Right. So I think that what we'll see is that a lot that has to do in just war theory is it's teleological. What is the goal or end of the said war? And the goal or end from a Christian perspective has to be complete justice. And so justice is going to have to be something that looks at the whole of the society involved in the war, and you're hoping for a better outcome. So just to go in, get the bad guys and leave would not rise to the level of doing justice to a society. Now, just war theory can be discussed in a theoretical sense, that is, war and something of an abstract concept and whether or not it can be just, or it can be applied to various wars and conflicts from history with a special interest in the international agreements or rules produced about war. So think about the Geneva Convention after the first two world wars. And so that's kind of an aspect of just war theory.
And one of the things, too, as Catholic social teaching has unfolded in the later 20th century, early 21st century, is there has been a shift away from purely national considerations when it comes to just war to international law and the international community playing a role in adjudicating various conflicts as far as whether they're just or not. So the point being is it shouldn't just be up to the United States to say we need to go in and, you know, bomb so and so, or it shouldn't just be up to Canada to go, you know, invade such and such, although I can't imagine Canada invading anybody really. I mean, you know, but the point.
Hey, they have the largest standing army in the world.
That is true, but I mean they're just so nice. So, anyways, but
they're so nice.
But yeah, so it has to be done in an increasingly sort of globalized world. It has to be an increasingly global decision in order to engage in violence. And there's some good there, I think, as far as checks and balances go.
Yeah, I think so. I think what we've seen after the World Wars is the creation of the League of Nations, United Nations, these sorts of things that are attempting to set those parameters and keep nations in check as a global society, which is good. So you can discuss just war theory as either theoretical or more historical applicable rules that have been produced by nations and such, or collections of nations. For us today, I think we are most concerned with the theoretical and thus theological side of this conversation. So beginning with St. Augustine, Catholic thinkers have posited that war, while terrible in nearly every respect, is not always the worst outcome. Nations have certain responsibilities that might lead to war in order to avoid even worse outcomes or atrocities or injustices being perpetuated. Now, while not giving much detail to this concept, St. Augustine himself actually provided us with the phrase, just war, in his magnum opus, The City of God. He says, "But, say they, the wise man will wage just wars, as if he would not all the rather lament the necessity of just wars, if he remembers that he is a man. For if they were not just, he would not wage them, and would therefore be delivered from all wars." So it doesn't really say much about what is a just war, but it just simply giving us the concept that there is a distinction between an unjust war and a just war. You fast forward about 1,000 years, and it's Thomas Aquinas who developed this thought of just war the most and laid the foundation for future generations of Catholic-minded Christianity to continue wrestling with the concept. He says that a war is not sinful and is thus just if it can meet three criteria. The first is the war must be waged upon the command of a rightful sovereign. So this is interesting and might not be something that always fits into a modern context, but it has to be waged upon the command of a rightful sovereign. And thus things like rebellions in his eyes are usually considered unjust. But there are situations in which rebellions against unjust rulers are considered just. So it's a sticky issue.
In the medieval period too, when Aquinas is writing this, I mean, it was easier. So if there was an injustice and a rebellion occurred because of it, they could appeal to the Pope as a sort of protector of that cause. So then the Pope, given medieval views of the Pope, he could be the sovereign that is the one who kind of commands the rightful war. So obviously, even in modern Catholicism, that view doesn't really fly the same way. It doesn't work the same way now. But
yeah, so this one would have to be translated into a context. But I think it does go against various types of warfare that we would see, gang wars or wars that go on in kind of third world countries that are more groups that don't have the authority that rally up troops and try to overtake or do other wars against other groups. I'm thinking of kind of the drug wars in Middle East or various other places. And so we really should be thinking of kind of, in our concept, constitutionally instituted nations that are waging war. That's kind of a first criteria. You don't just go to war for any sort of person or cause. Now, the second criteria that Thomas gives is that the war needs to be waged for just cause, on account of some wrong the attacked, that is the aggressor, has committed. And so to me, this is the hardest criteria to justify or prove. What actually leads someone to say, it is now a just cause for me to retaliate or to go to war?
And when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So it's easy, I think, when you're inhabiting a mindset that's informed by the military-industrial complex, for example, to see everything as a sort of justification to use violence, you know, when in reality that may not be the case.
Now, thirdly, according to Aquinas, warriors must have the right intent, namely to promote good and to avoid evil. And so we can think of certain situations within a war context that that need to take place in order for the war to rise to the level of just, avoiding civilian casualties and treating prisoners of war with dignity and only doing as much aggression or damage as necessary to promote the cause. So there has to be justice on the level of, in our terminology, the nation, the intent, and then as well as the individual tactics and warrior going on.
And we have to be, I think, self-reflective here. I think one of the strengths that we heard in the Brian Carroll interview was his ability to be self-reflective and self-critical before going out and being critical of others. Now, to some degree, you know, whether one country's committed a wrong doesn't justify other countries committing wrongs either. So there's a balance here. But, you know, when we think of American policies that include drone strikes, for example, I mean, you know, at first, I think drone warfare was extolled as something really nice because it you know, limits the number of casualties in a war. But really, it just kind of sanitizes our violence. And we know what has happened there with drone strikes and, you know, the deaths of innocent people, civilian lives being taken through those kind of things. And so that becomes really problematic for us, I think, and something that we have to kind of wrestle with.
Yeah. Well, because of this reasoning, Aquinas even said a war could be prompted offensively. That is, it isn't always just a retaliation. A nation could start a war and it be considered just. Now, such a preemptive war would have to be for the cause of overcoming existing injustice somewhere, which, according to Aquinas, should not be tolerated so as just to avoid battle. So in other words, just because you're looking at injustice out there, you don't intolerate grievous injustice because the only way to overcome it is a war. Again, part of just war theory is actually going to the war might be the only means to overcome an existing injustice. So in terms of moral culpability, Augustine, Aquinas, and many others have taught that if a soldier conducts himself or herself justly, i.e. not treating people unnecessarily cruel and avoiding casualties, civilian casualties, then killing enemy combatants is not considered a sin. They are acting as agents of the sovereign, or in our case, the state. Even in an unjust war, culpability falls to the powers that be and not necessarily the citizen warriors, so long as they maintain kind of above standard justice.
Yeah, so the point here is that, like, you hear some horror stories sometimes, you know, of in war where an individual soldier or soldiers will take it upon themselves to do violence to civilians, for example. So in that case, they would be squarely, you know, blamed from a moral sense for that. However, if they are instructed to do something, then the moral culpability is minimized for them because the sovereign who has the authority has told them to do so. Which is why being a soldier can be a tough place to be, I think. Not that one can't be a Christian and be a soldier, but that it can pose certain crises, I think, for the Christian soldier.
And I think you can see this played out in what happened after World War II. It wasn't every Nazi soldier put on trial. It was mostly, at the Nuremberg trials, was the leaders of the Nazi parties. They're the ones who were held morally culpable for the atrocities that took place. That's probably a difficult situation, but it's lesser moral culpability upon those low. But I think what Aquinas and the tradition's getting at is your sovereign seems to declare a case for a just war. You go off for that war. You do what you're told to do, and you come back and, you know, it turns out it's not a just war. Well, the culpability really rests in the sovereign and the powers that be, not in you. Now, in more recent development, the Roman Church developed four conditions for the use of military force in a defensive manner. Notice the assumption here in most modern conversations is that a nation would only ever retaliate. So these can be found in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2309. Here's the four. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. And so if a nation commits an act of aggression against another nation, it needs to be pretty serious and be pretty lasting in order for retaliation to take place. So there's actually a sense in which, according to this this teaching here in the Catechism, nations should turn the other cheek as much as they can. Now, the next one is all other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. So a nation really does need to exhaust other means of conflict resolution before war is called into action. I think we can see in our previous generation how too often war becomes the quick and easy response to aggression rather than other means of diplomacy. The third is there must be serious prospects of success. So according to modern Catholic social teaching, you actually can't engage in a war if you know you're going to lose, because you're putting your civilian or your soldiers at a great risk of damage and of death. Now, I'm not sure how that applies to individual battles. It reminds me of the storming of Normandy. Was that unjust for America to send their soldiers in knowing that there was going to be roughly, I can't remember, is it 70% casualties? So again, we're not really talking about the historic side of it, but that you need to go into a war thinking that you're going to have a prospect of success. And then finally, the fourth is the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. And I'm almost positive this is a way of saying, hint, hint, nuclear weapons are not to be used. And in fact, nuclear weapons have been deemed unequivocally unjust by Catholic social teaching. There is in no way a situation in which a nuclear weapon is permitted and is seen as just. Because of this, it promotes too much evil, causes too much evil in the wake of the battle than what it was trying to overcome. Or at least that's the modern way of thinking.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, yeah.
So another important side of the conversation that is discussed in modern times is the responsibility of nations to ensure peace, not only within her own borders, but within the human family as a whole. And so you can think of the Catholic social principle of solidarity. And this is something Father Wesley was getting at earlier. That is, now that we live in a more globalized society, there's a responsibility of not just America keeping America at peace, but there is a sense of if our neighbors or our sister nations are struggling, that we can come together and try to thwart the aggressor. And so world war is a new, unique thing, but it is actually something in Catholic social teaching that is, it is a good thing if it's necessary, meaning it's good for nations to work together for lesser, quote-unquote, brother and sister nations. So in light of all this tradition and teaching, the United States College of Catholic Bishops issued the following six principles for a just war. The first principle is just cause, to confront, quote, a real and certain danger, and to protect innocent life. The second one is competent authority, that is declared by those with responsibility for public order. So that's a way of translating Thomas's notion of under the rightly appointed sovereign. The third principle is comparative justice, and this asks the question: are the values at stake critical enough to override the presumption against war? So there's a presumption that should be in our minds against war. And so you have to ask, is what's at stake strong enough to override that presumption, which should be a strong presumption? The fourth is right intention. War can only be conducted to satisfy the just cause. And then the fifth one is last resort. All peaceful alternatives have already been exhausted. The next is last resort. All peaceful alternatives have already been exhausted. And the sixth, and actually there's seven of these. Sorry, I messed up earlier. The sixth is probability of success. The outcome cannot be disproportionate or futile. And then the seventh and final one is proportionality. Inflicted damage must be proportionate to the good expectant. And so that's an idea of saying that you can't just go blow a nation off the map for a small offense they committed against you. There has to be some sense of proportionality and knowing when to stop in terms of war. You don't just keep aggressing and aggressing and aggressing. So where does this leave us? Father Wesley, what are your kind of thoughts about just war theory?
Well, I think you and I hold similar assessments to it, which is that I can certainly agree with the abstract notion of just war theory. But I doubt it's often, if ever, really employed correctly. So one of the things I think we have to grapple with here is the deceitfulness of the human heart, because it becomes very easy for us to construct these various scenarios to justify violent interventionism without seeking a better, more peaceful way forward in various conflicts. So I think, for instance, it would be really hard for many Americans living within the military-industrial complex to adequately grapple with the various criteria of just war. And so I think we have to be very careful, and this is where I'm kind of glad to see that shift in Catholic social teaching place the impetus more on the international community rather than merely individual nations kind of coming up with their own justifications.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's well said. I too think that, theoretically speaking, I would hold to some sort of just war theory and would say that a war can, in theory, given these criteria, be a just endeavor. However, like you said, I'm just not convinced any war has yet to rise to such a standard. Or perhaps I could say wars are such a complicated, multifaceted concept that I'm not sure a single war has fully met such standards or ideal. There might be aspects of a war that are just. It could be unjust intent, but the soldiers act above reproach. Or it could be the other way around, right? And so there's so many various aspects of a war that can you really look at one single war and say every part of it was just? Seems a bit of a far cry, in my opinion. But still, theoretically speaking, I think that there's arguments to be made.
So that leads us to the next poll. So we've talked about just war theory, but now we're going to talk a little bit about the opposite, which is pacifism, or a position that would emphasize nonviolence. Now, of course, the two aren't wholly exclusive in the sense that, as we said with just war theory, the presumption is always against war, that it emphasizes the necessity of exhausting all routes to peace prior to war. So it's not as though people who argue for just war are necessarily, warmongering or something like that. But in very recent history, there has been a move, even within the Roman Church and different parts of the Roman Church, away from the idea of just war theory towards a more positive theology of peace and nonviolence. We could call this pacifism in that it limits and focuses narrowly on the topic of war and not peace. So pacifism would be the belief that, you know, all acts of war are unjust and immoral, that we should never participate. And of course, Pope Francis has been vocal about wishing the church to abandon just war and to adopt a just peace vision and theory. But he's still backed, you know, military involvement against ISIS, for example, because it was, quote, licit to stop the unjust aggressor. So there are times where even someone like Pope Francis might still argue for the use of force.
Yeah, I think that the emphasis going on here is a shift away from kind of the conversation being about war and what is a just war to let's create a positive vision of peace and how do we work towards peace, not just in the absence of war, but in a holistic concept. And so, and this goes to Pope Francis, he says that the abolition of war was the, quote, ultimate and most deeply worthy goal of human beings and human society. So we can say that he really strongly stated his case. But the idea is that war brings about so much atrocity and injustice in the world that we should be really striving to stop wars before they ever start. And not just sitting around asking the questions, well, is this going to be just or unjust?
One might here find a corollary between Jesus' teaching on divorce and the Catholic social teaching that Francis is advocating here, which is a sort of the ideal is that it would never happen, but because of the stubbornness of the human heart, there are some allowances for it under the right conditions, something like that. So according to this newer emphasis on a positive peace, positive vision of peace and nonviolence, there are some criteria that Catholic thinkers have come up with for defining how a peaceful society should work. So the first is the idea of rule of law. The state should have just laws and people should obey those laws. And I think they would say the state should have mechanisms in place to enforce those laws. But part of that includes the people enjoying the full gamut of human rights. So the state recognizes that their citizens are human beings and treats them as such. And flowing from that is the principle that the economy must be just, that there can't be, vast swaths of economic inequality and economic exploitation of people, because that would also be dehumanizing and a way of denying people access to full human rights. It also entails that people are able to grow to their full potential. Basically, that a society is a place where humans can flourish as humans, not as cogs in the machine.
Yeah, and I think that this kind of pushes against nations that still have a class system, or like I'm not trying to pick on any one nation, but I think of India that still has a caste system. And so certain individuals, based on how they're born or where, there's no way to break out of the system. And they would say that that's an unjust or an unpeaceful society.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that also means then that people are at harmony with one another. So I think the problem in a society where there is a strong emphasis on class or caste, you kind of have to have a state of conflict between the various castes, right? I mean, your upper class has to sort of always be subjugating your lower classes. And so then there's going to be the lower class will then have to react against that in order to be recognized as human. And so there's not harmony. But however we have our society structured, it needs to be in a way that encourages harmony amongst people so that there can be cooperation and participation rather than only ever competition between the various groups that make up a society. And finally, and I think this is important and kind of really buttresses all of the points up till now, is that this society, the peaceful society, will have people equipped with the skills of solving conflict without violence. So you give people the mechanisms and the means to solve problems before they have to become violent in order to fix anything. So again, that can be kind of tricky. You think about, like, for example, in the United States, I mean, some of the great social changes that we've experienced culturally have had to be brought about through various aspects of violence and things like that. So it basically, we're encouraged here to conceive of a different way, a new way to arrange ourselves socially where we don't have to make progress on various issues through violence.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And so kind of to wrap that all up then, there's been an emphasis to push citizens and Christians who are citizens in their nations to take an active role of becoming peacemakers. Where can you find avenues to promote peace and kind of get ahead of the ball before we lead to war? So I think that's a worthy endeavor. Wes, what are your thoughts on kind of just war versus the peacemaker side, we could call it?
Well, I know that you and I have had some conversations about these before, and I think we might disagree, but maybe only slightly, which is that I would probably identify more on the side of pacifism. I might buy the abstract notion of just war, like I said earlier, even though I'm skeptical that it's ever really been employed correctly. But I do think the biggest issue for me when it comes to the just war vision is that while I might be able to understand it in the abstract, when we look at the cross, I think it's hard to justify violence. You know, that love we should always understand as a kind of pouring oneself out for the other. And so then it raises the question, well, what situation then am I able to wield violence against, you know, someone else when I'm looking at the cross, when I'm trying to be conformed to the image of Christ who was crucified? And, you know, to be fair, I'm speaking from the position of a clergyman who really can't participate in violence. But even then, the call is for all Christians to live cruciform lives, no matter what they are and whether they're clergy or laity or whatever their vocations are. So I think it's a tricky issue. I certainly don't judge people who would come down a little differently than I would on this, but I personally would have a good deal of struggle with putting just war into practice.
Yeah, I think I would nuance it differently, and I probably land more on the just war side because I totally understand what you're saying of looking at the cross and nonviolence being kind of a way forward. And I think that most definitely applies on the individual level. And so when I look at these two concepts, just war, the peacemaker side, I don't see them as necessarily mutually exclusive, that I think individuals as Christians in their society should promote peace, and we should be looking to create societies that match these different criteria of a just peace society. But the fact is that when we are surrounded by conflicts and the inevitability of war does come upon us, to a nation that's promoting peace from a nation that's not promoting peace, I think that a nation does have a responsibility to protect its citizens and to have to be able to engage in retaliation, which would mean violence. And so it's not ideal, but I think that you need to have these categories and be able to work out how to wage a war that would be as just as possible, but while also hopefully on the ground level leading towards more peaceful societies. And then I'll just end by, I really appreciate what you've been bringing up. And I think it's a really good point that we're actually in a better situation because we are a more global society in this regard. It can't just be one nation decides to pick on another. And a nation across the country doesn't find out about it, right? Everyone is so connected today that we know any sort of little skirmishes and battles that are going on. And so I think that as a whole, we are working together for a more peaceful earth. And that's good, but it might take time to get there, and there might be other skirmishes in between. So that's kind of where I would come out, is that I think that it might be a bit utopian to lean heavily into a pacifist position, and that the nation that does might unfortunately be one that's picked off by the aggressor. And so there has to be a sense in which we are able to defend and protect our own. And I think the government has that responsibility. But as individual Christians, like, I think that, yeah, I think nonviolence should be a pretty obvious thing. We shouldn't be gunning for who can I shoot, or who can I defend myself against, or anyway. But that's a different concept, different conversation. Well, all right. I think it's that time of the show that everyone looks forward to. It's Father Creighton's Anglo-Catholic Corner. Father Creighton, take us away.
Welcome to another installment of Father Creighton's Anglo-Catholic Corner. Today, I want to start off by introducing a new segment that's going to take place within Father Creighton's Anglo-Catholic Corner. It's not going to be every episode, but we are going to sprinkle them throughout this season and the next season, and who knows, maybe even after that. But the new series is going to be called Fathers and Mothers in the Faith. And what that is we're going to do some biographical sketches of some of the most significant and important figures in the Anglo-Catholic movement. So we're going to be covering people like Conrad Knoll or Frank Weston or Alfred Hope Patton or John Keble. And the goal will just be to give people a little bit more information, but also to sort of expand horizons and show that what we do as Christians and what we do specifically as Anglo-Catholics is rooted not in the whims of a particular individual, but that they are rooted in the ancient tradition of the Church. They are rooted in 2,000 years of living witness, all the way back to the apostles. And so today, we're going to talk about one of the most well-known and famous Anglo-Catholic priests, and that is Alfred Hope Patton. Father Alfred Hope Patton, the famous Anglo-Catholic priest who restored the shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham, is known throughout the world. Father Hope Patton, known affectionately as Pat to his friends, was born on the 17th of November, 1885, and died on the 11th of August, 1958. Hope Patton came to the joys of Anglo-Catholicism as a teenager while in Brighton. His interests in the medieval church and the religious life came through his contact with Anglican Benedictines at Painsthorpe. The abbot there, Alred Carlisle, had a profound influence on the young Alfred Hope Patton. He attended Lichfield Theological College and was ordained a deacon in 1913 at Holy Cross, Cromer Street, St. Pancras in London. After serving a total of four curacies, he came to Walsingham as the vicar. The parish was active and focused on the centrality of the Mass, and he arrived to find a beautiful alabaster statue of Our Lady installed in the church. And no doubt God brought Father Hope Patton to this place with the ground already tilled so that he could begin his work re-establishing the ancient medieval pilgrimage site there at Walsingham. When Father Patton accepted the living at Walsingham, he foresaw the possibilities it presented for restoring the shrine. He had a particular devotion to Our Lady. He was a sound medievalist, and he was a man of vision and imagination. He was well-loved by his people and possessed the unique ability of inspiring leadership and a capacity to draw people into his vision. Given his work on the medieval church, he knew the importance of a pilgrimage site, and he knew the importance of re-establishing Walsingham as the center of Marian devotion in England. Throughout his ministry, he worked tirelessly to educate the faithful about the importance of Marian devotion, and he spent countless hours building the shrine into a renewed place of pilgrimage, holiness, and devotion. Now, much more could be said of this great priest, but for the sake of time, we'll conclude with a quotation from John Barnes, who summarizes the impact of Father Hope Patton's legacy. He says, "Largely through the initiative of Father Patton, an important element in the Catholic revival in the Church of England has been brought about, the revival of a national shrine, to serve not only as a focus for devotion to the Mother of Jesus, but also as a proclamation of the reality of the Incarnation, which lies at the heart of all Catholic thinking, social, and theological." So Father Patton's legacy in terms of Anglo-Catholicism is without doubt one of the most significant legacies in recent times. Father Patton worked tirelessly for the restoration of one of the most beautiful Marian shrines that you can find. So, what does that mean for us? Well, at the end of the day, what it means is that we follow Father Patton's example. We dive into the beauties of incarnational Christianity. We dive into the beauties of the sacramental life, the centrality of the Mass. We dive into the reality that God became man for us, that we might live the divine life. And our primary example for what it means to live a Christian life is none other than the Blessed Virgin Mary herself. God bless you, and remember, more lace, more grace.
All right, and we're back. Now let's talk about what we're into before we conclude today's episode. Father Wes, what are you into?
Well, I've been trying to read more fiction this year. I think I've mentioned that before. And I've had a lot of fun reading some really good Catholic novels. And so I picked up a series that I can't believe it's taken me this long to revisit, but that is the Redwall series. The Redwall series. So for those of you who don't know what Redwall is, it's think medieval monastic Christianity with anthropomorphic animals. That is what Redwall is, and it is fantastic. I read them, you know, growing up in middle and high school and really loved them. And I think probably they have to be an evidence that there will be animals in heaven. I have a friend, Marco, who said, "I think we need to accept the implication that Mouse Jesus existed in Redwall to die for their rodent sins." it is interesting. I mean, they have their own little abbey and their own church, Saint Ninian's Church. So it's kind of a cool series, and I really appreciate it. And so I'm glad to revisit it. It'll be wonderful. I can't wait for our kids to get older so we can have, you know, family read alouds of Redwall books. I think that'll be really wonderful.
Oh, really cool. Yeah, I need to look into that. I'm not sure I've ever heard or read a book from that series.
I'm really surprised that you wouldn't have heard about it, but you know, better late than never.
Yeah, sure. That, well, it'll be good stuff I can visit with Milo and other kids as they get older. All right, so what am I into? I'm actually into more chickens. I know. So I mentioned on the podcast, months ago that we got chickens, and we've unfortunately lost a few because of predation. So we think one was taken by a coyote. One was definitely taken by a raccoon. I've actually caught the raccoon. And so I wouldn't say on a whim. It was calculated over a few hours, but we went and got more baby chickens, and we're raising them and going to put them in our backyard. So it's led me to reflect and think more about kind of what does it mean to be connected to the earth and connected to food and production and these sorts of things. It goes against the grain of kind of American instant gratification culture, because you have to wait, you have to raise these chickens. Our chickens, the first batch, have started to lay eggs, which is really cool, really fun to know that you've kind of producing stuff on your own land. So kind of channeling that Wendell Berry spirit of kind of connectivity and spirituality around land and small-scale farming and subsidiary, that sort of stuff. So it's fun. It's more than just a hobby. I see it as kind of also a bizarre spiritual exercise. Well, before we conclude, Father Wes, would you talk about an upcoming event we have?
Yeah. So we're excited to bring back our series of talks that we were doing last season for Patreon members. So if you join our Patreon for $5 a month, we will give you the Zoom link so that you can join us for various discussions on certain topics that are pertinent to the season's theme that we're discussing. So our first event is going to be March 23rd at 8 p.m. And Father Miles is going to lead us in a discussion on Evangelium Vitae. So the event is titled Revisiting Evangelium Vitae, an evening discussion on Pope John Paul II's encyclical. Father Miles, could you give us a little bit of a preview? What exactly is Evangelium Vitae about?
Yeah, I would say that it is a holistic papal encyclical about pro-life, kind of womb to tomb. So we're going to be looking at pro-life issues and what it means to be theologically a pro-life Christian, and what the implications it has for not just being pro-life for babies in the womb, but the broad spectrum of a Christian existence as pro-life, and then it being rooted in theology. So if you want to get a copy of Evangelium Vitae, you can. It's free on the Vatican website, or you can order a copy. It might be worthwhile if you're interested to read through and prompt that discussion. It'll be kind of an overview as well as some engagement with it. And we should add the caveat that my wife, on this day that we are recording, is 37 weeks pregnant. And so there is quite a good chance that I will be not... There's a chance that this event might have to be postponed, or in which case I believe that Father Wesley or Father Creighton are kind of going to be up to bat to discuss another encyclical.
Yeah, we'll make something happen that night, and if you can't be there, then we'll postpone and you can do your talk at another time. But one thing that will be a little different this season that was different from last season is last season we recorded these events and then we released them as bonus episodes. We're not going to be doing that this year. So the audio will be recorded, but it will only be available for Patreon subscribers. So more incentive for you to go join the Patreon Communion of Patreon Saints for $5 a month so that you can participate in these events as well.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of today's episode. If you like what we're doing here, dear listeners, help other people find us by rating and reviewing us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and share us with your friends. And if you want to continue the conversation with us, follow us on Twitter and join our Facebook group and let us know what you think.
Yeah, and one other plug for our Patreon, since we've talked about the events too, is we've recently set up a Discord community where Patreon supporters can engage more. So it's a little bit, I think, preferable to Facebook groups. It's not, it doesn't take the place of, I mean, we still engage listeners there too, but the Discord allows, I think, a more immediate and better conversation. So if you want to join that, you can also join our Patreon and we'll send you the invitation so that you can sign up for it.
Yes, lots of fun there. Well, Father Wesley, will you conclude us today by praying the prayer for social justice?
Almighty God, who has created man in thine own image, grant us grace fearlessly to contend against evil and to make no peace with oppression, and that we may reverently use our freedom, help us to employ it in the maintenance of justice among men and nations, to the glory of thy holy name, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.